How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast.
Sponsored by Glamdoor, creating space for business to grow.
Hello, hello, and welcome to How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast series with myself, Nadina Regan. In this podcast series, we talk to women who are at the forefront of their professions and hear their stories. We also get advice from experts in areas that people traditionally find difficult to navigate. Later on in this episode, I'll be joined by Louise Campbell of the recruitment consultancy Robert Walters. She'll be in to dispense advice on how to approach your boss about getting a raise. But now I'm delighted to tell you that our guests on this episode of How I Did It, coming to you from our studio space in the Dublin 2 home of our sponsored Glamdoor, are two women who'll be well known to anyone in Ireland who follows news and current affairs. Rachel English is co-presenter of Morning Ireland on RT Radio 1 and the author of 6 novels, including her latest, The Letter Home, a gripping saga that takes us from modern-day Ireland and Boston to famine times and back again. Zara King is news correspondent with Virgin Media and now co-host of a new podcast too, The Group Chat, with her Virgin Media colleagues Richard Chambers and Gavin Riley. In the podcast you're about to hear, Rachel and Zara speak about what it's like reporting in an extraordinary era for journalism. They also talk about their early days in reporting and how they deal with stress, which in their jobs there's a lot of. Not that it seems to bother them. It was great to speak to them both. An absolute pleasure. Here, without further ado, is Zara King's and Rachel English's How I Did It.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
Rachel and Zara, you are both so welcome to the podcast. How are you?
Thank you, Nadine. Thanks for having us.
Great, thank you.
Listen, it's a pleasure to have you in and lovely to see you in person after hearing your voice, Rachel, for so many mornings of Morning Ireland, and Zara, seeing you beaming from the television screen. I'm dying to find out a little bit more about your careers and how you got to where you are now. But before we do that, it struck me coming in to the podcast this morning that the term was used again, unprecedented times. And certainly it seemed that barely had we escaped the heavier restrictions that the pandemic had wrought, then we emerged very quickly into a scenario that seems cataclysmic from so many different perspectives. The war in Ukraine, the rising costs for ordinary people living in Ireland, the swarms of people coming in and needing assistance, needing help, the government being forced to turn and turn about as they search for solutions. This really is an incredible circumstance to find oneself in, and both of you are at the coalface of it. So, Rachel, maybe to start with you, one of your jobs is to reflect the mood of the nation. What is the mood of the nation currently?
Oh my gosh, that's such a big question. It's a hard one to answer. I think people are very, very engaged with what's happening in Ukraine. When I was on my way here this morning, I was walking down the street. I met a guy who I hadn't seen in a couple of years, and I realised straight away, oh, I might be late for my appointment because we're going to have to talk about Ukraine, because he was really exercised, and rightly so. I find that it is what everybody is talking about. I find that even among people, the people I work with, I've never known a time when so many people have admitted to being upset by the news. The first evening that I cried watching the news, I felt like a complete fool. You have that feeling, you think, well, you know, these aren't my tears to shed. It's nothing to do with me. And I just mentioned it at work the next morning. And every single person, including the men, said that they had done exactly the same thing because they felt completely helpless. You can, if you have money to donate, you can. But there is this sense where we're watching this, we're hearing about it, you're talking to people on the radio who, I don't think there's ever been a time before where I have interviewed people where I felt that they're so close to tears a lot of the time, including journalists. And it's, people are immensely engaged, but at the moment, it's so hard to know what's going to happen. Where is this going to go? How long can it continue, and how will it be brought to an end? It's like you say, you know, I hate to use the word normally, extraordinary, because it is overused, but these are extraordinary times, and I think most of us are conscious of that.
They say journalism is the first draft of history, But in your circumstances, through radio and television, you really are at the coalface. Zara, how have you found reporting over the past few months, but particularly, I guess, in the last few weeks?
Yeah, I would echo everything that Rachel just said. Actually, I think she really hit the nail on the head in terms of that bubbling emotion that people are feeling, actually, and that everyone you meet is almost genuinely on the verge of tears about what's happening in Ukraine. I spent some time in recent weeks on the Ukrainian border in Poland with my colleague, Joan McKenna. And both of us were really, you know, shocked by the amount of children that we came across. And, you know, we went out on that assignment knowing that this was going to be difficult and knowing that we were going to see a lot of very sad things. I don't think that I was prepared emotionally for the amount of children that we met and how I felt about seeing those children coming over the border and not knowing what the future would hold for them. And, you know, I've no problem in admitting that Joan and I did shed some tears on that assignment privately. I have said before, I didn't feel like, obviously, it wasn't appropriate for me to, you know, cry into people's faces. You know, this is not, as you said, Rachel, my, you know, tears to shed, but really, really emotional. And I think in terms of the response, I'm really proud of Ireland, actually. I'm really proud of us as a country and the way that we have responded. Friends and colleagues who have any sort of spare room are pledging them and trying to help. But yeah, it's a really difficult job. But again, I think there's a responsibility there in what Rachel and I do in terms of giving people a voice and an opportunity to tell those stories. And, you know, I take that quite seriously. And I really do feel like that's a privilege in a lot of ways, too. And I don't take that for granted.
Sometimes, and I particularly noticed, Sarah, during the pandemic, we're still in the pandemic, but during an earlier phase of the pandemic, you were very adept at reflecting the questions that the public had actually sent to you via DM on Twitter or maybe through other forms of social media, and asking questions of politicians that the ordinary person in the street really wanted to know. This time around, you know, what do you think the ordinary person in the street really wants to know?
There's a couple of questions I think that come in very often, actually, is why is this happening? And I don't know if any of us really have the answer to that. Unfortunately, we can keep searching for it and we can keep asking questions to try and get to the bottom of that. Why is this happening is the first question. The second is, what can we do to help? And, you know, like I said earlier, I do think Irish people are responding in a way that is the best they can. But in terms of the why is this happening question, it's just really difficult to get to the bottom of that. You know, I think that when you reflect back on some of the questions during the pandemic, obviously, sometimes people sort of laughed at the fact that I would ask the CMO when would hairdressers reopen. And
listen, I was here for that question.
I know. I think we all were, to be honest.
I mean, but it was like, it became something that was becoming like a daily, you know, hi, Zara, sorry, like, I know there's a massive crisis on, but I'm just wondering when, you know, I don't want my husband to have to put the colour in my hair again. And that was witty at the time. And maybe it was a bit of light relief in what was a really tough time. But honestly, they were things that people wanted to know about. Likewise with their weddings. And another question that was really common was couples that didn't live together wanted to know when was it going to be safe to resume an intimate relationship. I mean, was that a difficult question for me to ask Tony Houlihan? Yeah, I was a bit embarrassed, if I'm honest, but I also felt that, like, it's my job as a journalist to ask the questions people want the answers to. So on that basis, I sort of plucked up the courage and went ahead and did it. So
the thing is, these are questions about people's lives.
Yeah.
And I always felt with COVID that there were several layers. And obviously there were huge questions, say, about nursing homes. There were questions about hospitals and that. But there were the day-to-day questions about people's lives, yeah, as well. And, you know, there were the questions like, when can my children go back to school? When can I stop cutting my husband's hair? When all of those things did matter as, yeah, well. And for a time, that's all that there was. That's all we had to talk about because everything 100%. Else had shut down.
Well, one of the most powerful statements I think you can make as a journalist is to turn around to your interviewee and say, I don't understand. But it's something that oftentimes you have to have enough experience to have the balls to say it in a way. But sometimes then you get the fuller response because somebody feels compelled to give you exactly the correct information and exactly the correct scenario. But, you know, from your perspective, Rachel, like, do you have to do that often on Morning Ireland where you go, I don't get it, or tell me, you know, because I notice the way you phrase questions, you know, they have to be short, they have to be to the point. So you don't have much space if someone is stonewalling.
Yeah, I always think, I remember somebody said to me many years ago that the best question of all is why.
Yeah.
And that nearly every response somebody gives you can you can respond back with, why? And it is a very good question. I mean, you can't use it all the time, but it's good to have it in the back of your head. Obviously, you can't know everything about every subject. And as much as you might try to read yourself into a particular area, there are times, you know, there are some issues on which I might consider myself moderately well informed, and then something else will pop up and you realise I know very, very little about this. I mean, say, let's go back 6 weeks. I wouldn't have been able to tell you whereabouts all the cities in Ukraine were. I think that's something that we've all had to learn pretty quickly about its geography and, you know, which, I mean, I would have known that where Kiev was. I would have known that Donetsk and Luhansk were were in the Russian speaking area, but other than that I wouldn't have known a lot. So I think you have to try and educate yourself all the time, but I mean that's part of the job, mm-hmm. you know, and no more than any job that there is this constant, you know, trying to keep on top of things.
Well, somebody once said to me that my job was a little bit like watching somebody constantly cram for their junior cert. Do you feel like that occasionally, Zara?
Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, I remember one time having to do a story on the Chinese stock market. Like, what do I know about the Chinese stock market? And I remember going at that story and thinking, well, if I don't understand it, there's a strong chance of huge portion of our viewers probably don't. So I went at that story in a way that tried to break it down, and I remember going looking for like an Irish company that exports to China to try and make it relevant, but I was equally learning on foot while I was making that story as much as I was in terms of bringing it to the news that evening. But I remember even there were times for like a good few weeks in the pandemic where this term S-gene target failure, S-gene dropout, I hadn't a clue what that meant for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it was kind of getting to the point where it was really too late to ask the question. I was a bit embarrassed about it, and in the end I was getting a tour of the lab and back question, and I was like, it was like the guy that stood up on the bus and said, I don't know what a tracker mortgage is. I was like, I don't know what and so they explained it to me, and effectively it was this blue line and whether the blue line was there or not. And I remember, and I went, oh, so it's just like a blue line. And they were like, we cannot believe that you've reduced the scientific marvel to like a blue line. But you know, that was just my only way of sort of asking the question and being able to explain it to people.
I'm still struggling with the NFTs, non-fungible tokens.
I constantly
trying to understand that one. Now, in your new book, actually, Rachel, there's a great paragraph in it because Jesse, one of the lead characters, it's a fascinating book, by the way. I have been tearing through it, so I highly recommend going out and getting a copy. But Jesse is a journalist and one of the lead characters, and there's a paragraph where the comment goes, they were writing of Dublin, there were too many journalists and too few paying jobs. Dublin was overflowing with young reporters who were willing to write whatever their bosses wanted while shooting a video, recording a podcast and engaging in spirited arguments on Twitter. Newsrooms were either staffed by interns or by creaking veterans with nowhere to go. The veterans spoke about the atrocities they'd covered and the expenses they'd claimed while lamenting young people's lack of initiative. Grim.
I don't think it's quite as grim as that in the real world. I suppose coming from Jessie, the character's perspective, she's just lost all of her work through her own fault, it has to be said. So she clearly has quite a jaundiced eye to cast over things. It's certainly far, far harder for young journalists now than it was when I started work as a journalist. Like, I'm working as a journalist for more than 30 years. And in my first job in Clare FM back in 1989, I mean, I worked very hard, and I think people in local radio are probably the hardest working people in journalism. But what I was expected to do wasn't on a par with what is expected of young people now. And also, even though it wasn't a particularly well-paid job, it was a contract. It was regular work. You know, I had paid leave. There were terms and conditions to my employment. And I think for an awful lot of young people now, that isn't there. And you can have the best idea in the world. You can be willing to work really, really hard and still find that there are so many obstacles in your way. And, I mean, it sounds in one way funny to say that it was easier in 1989 because there was 15% unemployment in 1989. So, you know, for many people, it wasn't. But I think once you got in the door at all, it was easier to make progress. Whereas now, I do think it is very, very tough for young people starting in journalism now. I really do. Also, there are so many more young journalists now. Like, back then, there was a certificate in Rathmines and a postgrad in DCU. That was it in terms of professional qualifications. Now there are just endless courses and people coming from other areas who want to work as a journalist. Not, by the way, saying that you should have to do journalism at college to become a journalist. Of course, you shouldn't. There should always be other paths in. But I do think it's harder now, yeah.
Sarah, do you think it's a vocational career?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I suppose I had a similar path to you, Rachel, in the sense that I started in local radio as well in WLR in Waterford. I was 15 when I went in there and I made cups of tea and did Vox Pops for as long as was possible. And I went there after school through fifth and even sixth year at times. And yeah, I mean, you know, it's something that I have always said to people who want to be a journalist, like if you're offered a story or an opportunity, just say yes and figure out logistically how you'll get it done later. Just say yes to everything and put everything aside. You know, I didn't go on the J1 in college because I had a part-time job in radio. So I was in journalism school basically Monday to Thursday. I had no lectures on a Friday and I was in WLR or Beach 102, 103, which is in the same building. And I worked between the two radio stations Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So I didn't have a day off when I was in college because, and I didn't really want it either because I loved this and I was passionate about it and I knew I wanted to do this. But yeah, I would say don't become a journalist if you think you're going to finish at 5 o'clock in the evening, because you're just not. And the truth is the news is a 24-hour cycle and you always have to be on. But if you love it like I do, it doesn't feel like that either. So when you say vocational, yes, but I adore what I do. And if, the minute I stop loving it, I'm sure I'll stop doing it then. But, you know, so it doesn't feel like a chore. But I do think you need to be honest with people and say that this is not something that you're going to have, you know, finish at, you know, an early... Like, I'm never going to, I never, the news is at 5:30, I never finish at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, like, just would never happen, you know, so, yeah.
I do think you have to be a bit of an obsessive as well. If you're not a bit of an obsessive, if you aren't the teenager who listens to the radio or reads the papers, that I don't think you're going to be able to turn it on later. It's a bit like you mentioned writing books. It's like people who say, oh, well, when I get more time or when I retire or whatever, it's kind of like, if you don't at least chip away at it now, the chances are you will always find an excuse. And it's the same with news. If it's not part of who you are, and if you're not one of those people who thinks, tell me what's going on. If you're not a bit nosy, it's probably not for you. And that's the truth of it.
No, she's right. Yeah, you have to be really nosy.
You do. You have to want to know what's happening.
So is it the chase and the story that is the key element for you?
Gosh, that's a hard one now. I suppose the key element for me, it was when I was a reporter, certainly, it was constantly trying to come up with ideas and different ways of doing things. And as a presenter, it's the challenge is more, I think as well, because I've been doing it for quite a while, I think the challenge is to remain engaged and to continue to give it everything you've got. I mean, the one thing that I do try to remember to say to myself every morning climbing the stairs, going to the newsroom at about 5:15 is there's only today. So, you know, today is the only day. Keep your mind on today. Keep your mind on the next 3 or 4 hours and everything after that, you know, worry about it later on. I don't always live up to that. I don't think anybody does. But I do try and remain engaged with what I'm doing, because Zara mentioned the word privilege earlier, and it is a privilege, and sometimes you forget that and you get kind of caught up in office politics or nonsense, or you start to feel sorry for yourself, you know, if you're tired or whatever. And you know, sometimes I do have to kind of take myself into the corner and say, cop yourself on. It is a privilege to do what you do. It is a great job. You don't always get it right. None of us do. There have been times over the past 2 or 3 years where, you know, I've really questioned what we do. But I think you have to be conscious that you're fortunate to do it and to keep on trying to do your best.
You have many hundreds of thousands of viewers and listeners between you, and the world has changed in relation to the advent of social media, meaning that you're not far away at any point from a meme or a video that goes around. So Zara, is that something that you think about, or can you allow yourself to think about that? Because as Rachel was saying, everyone has a bad day, everyone has a gaffe.
Yeah, we do. And the truth is, no, I don't think about it too much. I try not to, because I think you wouldn't move forward, would you, if you were frozen by the thoughts of that? Yeah, like everything that you do is kind of out there, and it's different to other people's jobs in a sense that, you know, if people have an opinion about your job and they think you've had a bad day, they'll send an email to the newsroom to let the newsroom know that you should be fired for that terrible job you did. Or that, I was joking earlier on saying to both of you that people, I speak quite quickly, and now you both can attest that I speak quite quickly off air as well. And, you know, I'm very aware of how fast I speak, and it is something that I try to, you know, work on. But so often, more often than not, every day somebody will note that I speak very quickly and will either tweet about it or send an email to the newsroom. Why does Ara King speak so quickly? Why does she blink so much? You know, and all these kinds of things. And look, like, it depends on the day. It's something that might bother me if someone said that to me. Most of the time I'm like, whatever, I'm here to tell a story, I'm here to do the job. So you try not to get too bogged down, I think, in that sort of thing.
And friendship and camaraderie is obviously a part of it, because you're all in the same circumstance. Do you guys actually know each other?
No, we just met today, actually.
No, this is the first time we've met.
Yeah. I mean, amazing.
I kind of feel conscious now that, obviously, when I was a reporter, I felt like that I knew a lot of people. I don't anymore. Also, the past couple of years, I mean, there have been people who work in the same area as me. Actually, one or two who work on the same programme as me, who I haven't met in 2 years, because everybody has been broadcasting from back rooms and kitchens, and, you know, we're back to that a bit again at the moment. I mean, I think the past couple of years in particular have been strange like that. They really have.
Yeah, but even though we don't know each other, I actually want to say to you that you've shared and tweeted a lot of my stuff over the last 2 years, which I really appreciate, and thank you very much for that. So
it was lovely
when I met you today, because I just felt like, you know, even though we don't know one another, I felt actually very supported by you actually over the last 2 years with like retweets and things like that.
Well,
so thank you for that.
Likewise.
You
see, the thing about social media is it can be an awful place, and I felt in particular during the second long lockdown that it became increasingly fractious, because, to be fair, people were increasingly at the end of their tether, and there were, you'd read something and you know, I tried to console myself with, well, at least I don't have to live with that person, somebody does. And then you try to think, well, I'm sure they're not always like that, and I'm not talking about personal abuse or anything, I'm just talking about, you read an exchange between two people and you think, that's, we just step away from the phone there, step away from the keyboard. I'm sure you probably never met. I'm sure you can't loathe each other to quite that extent. But at the same time, there is a positive side to social media. You can, if not get to know people, you can certainly sort of build up, you know, a certain engagement with people, including listeners and viewers, that, you know, there is something to be said for it. It also does give a voice to people sometimes who might find it difficult to talk about their circumstances otherwise, in particular people who would say had a very tough time over the past couple of years, like carers or people with a chronic illness or whatever, and their stories. I think I became more conscious of their stories because you read somebody's thread on Twitter or whatever and you go, yeah, they have a point. They have a point, and I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, that understanding, the shared understanding that, you know, there is a certain amount of abuse that, you know, you may get as part of your job and you have to get on with it, and the camaraderie that is there. Zara, I know with yourself and Richard Chambers and Gavin Riley, you seem like such a tight bunch, and now you have a new podcast, yeah, The Group Chat. So tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah, so the boys and I are very close friends, actually, and have become even closer over the last 2 years in particular. So we had an actual group chat that we would talk to each other in all day, every day. And I suppose out of that, you know, we were both working in the group chat and also just kind of keeping up with each other. We had kind of talked ages ago about doing a podcast, and the timing kind of was never right. So then in the last few weeks, we sort of said, come on, let's actually get this done. So it was born out of a few things, Nadine. I suppose I was saying, you know, we have... My job has changed a lot, actually. When you spoke earlier about this idea that we're never too far away, maybe from people as well with social media, like people can contact you directly. And that's a great thing in a lot of ways too, because prior to the pandemic, you know, I might not have heard from our viewers as much as I have now. Now people, particularly for me on Instagram, every single day I wake up to, you know, 15 or 20 messages from people sort of asking questions about stories or you know, asking about different things, or maybe telling us they have a story. So there's been so much more engagement really with our audience, particularly people kind of under 45, I've noticed, for me on Instagram. And they ask us questions about the news, things that, you know, they're interested in. And we sometimes the boys will answer them on Twitter publicly or we'll DM people back. We just felt that there was a space to have a broader discussion about certain questions and topics that came up from our viewers. So that's where the group chat podcast was kind of born out of.
Well, the podcast, as we're speaking, is mere days away from launching. It'll be out by the time this podcast is out, but it's already number one, correct?
Which is so funny, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of embarrassing, but I mean, not an episode to our name. But yeah, so it's number one in the charts. So hopefully it will live up to all of those expectations. But yeah, so it's going to be a weekly release on a Thursday morning. So we'll be recording late on a Wednesday night. So it'll be released on a Thursday morning. It'll be about 30 or 40 minutes. And hopefully we want people to be able to listen and feel like they might walk away and feel a bit more knowledgeable as they sit at the brunch table on Saturday morning with their friends. That's kind of the goal.
Doesn't that go back in a way to you were asking about people's attitudes to Ukraine, to how invested people are, how yeah. engaged people are? You know, it's easy to say, oh, nobody cares about these things anymore, after they're all only going on the Instagram to learn how to do their makeup or whatever. Actually, you know, A, it's quite possible to be interested in doing your makeup and interested in what's happening in Ukraine.
Absolutely.
And it goes to show how invested people are, and how in this country, if you're a journalist, you're quite fortunate that we work in a world where actually people still do engage with what you do rather yeah. than turning their back on it and saying, you know, even if they only want to engage with you to tell you how useless you are, yeah. at least they're still listening,
chatting,
watching,
to you.
They're not ignoring
you. But the point you make is interesting, Rachel, isn't it? Because I always joke about my Instagram, because people will always message, oh, what mascara do you wear? What lipstick is that? And it's quite lovely. But I think, like, you know, come for the news, stay for the mascara if you want, or come for the mascara and stay for the news. Like, I don't really mind. You know what I mean? Like, both of those are, you know, things
you've 100% the best smoky eye on television.
I'll reveal later.
Well, this could be an alternative podcast here.
But I should say, actually, as well, before we get totally off topic, Rachel, you also had a number one hit with the new book, The Letter Home. So congratulations on that, because it must be pretty gratifying at this point in your career. I mean, still kind of butt a pup in the world of novels, really, and managing to successfully combine a career that is co-presenting on, you know, the biggest show on radio, and then, you know, casually publishing a novel to go in at number one in the charts.
It wasn't that casual, no, but I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, it was a surprise. It was a really, really pleasant surprise. I mean, the other books, you know, certainly in Ireland, they've done well. They've all been in the top 10, but this one, I suppose it's a bit different to other books I've written, in the sense that part of it is historical, part of it is set during the famine. And you just, when it was coming out, I thought, well, I don't really know, because parts of it, I'd like to think there's some humour in it, but parts of it are quite dark. And I was thinking, gosh, is this really the time to be bringing out a book that is in places quite dark? Because, you know, the period of time that it covers in the sort of historical part of it, you know, those were the darkest days that this country has ever seen.
Mm, famine times, yeah.
But again, it goes to show that, for me, I've been amazed. Like, say, a woman sent me a picture a couple of days ago of her great-great-great-grandmother, who, she's an old woman in the picture, but she presumably would have been a child during the famine, and it's amazing to think how close it is to us and how close that history is, and how every family in this country pretty much has a story. And that, so I suppose that's maybe helped people to engage with it. But yeah, I've been very fortunate with this one.
Do you think that what you've learned about people through the course of interviews on Morning Ireland and elsewhere has helped for fiction writing?
Yes, I do. I think that's fair. Even though in many ways they're very different, I think the thing about journalism is you get to meet all sorts of people. Now, I know that that's maybe true if you were a guard or worked in a hospital, that's probably also true. But you really do get to meet such an immense variety of people as a journalist. You get to see the best of life, and you get to see the very, very worst of life. Like, you get to see, like, the grimmest situations. You know, sometimes you are encountering people on the worst day of their lives. And then you also get to hear great success. You get to know about quite a lot of skullduggery. So, yes, I would say it's certainly helpful. It is.
Yeah. And Zara, what do you think you've learned about people through your years in journalism and obviously broadcast media?
God, it's such a good question, isn't it? What have I learned about people? I mean, the skullduggery is a great remark, Rachel. I think that point that Rachel makes is actually really valid, in that you kind of meet people sometimes on the worst day of their lives, actually, and you are responsible for sort of telling their story on that particular day. You know, I suppose fundamentally my takeaway from my time as a journalist and all the interviews that I've done is that I actually still believe, and maybe people might think this is quite naive, but I actually think that deep down there's kindness in everyone, actually, or certainly in the vast majority of people that you meet, actually, and that everyone's just doing their best for the most part, actually. And I really mean that. I know that sometimes that can be hard to believe, and maybe sometimes as journalists we can be, you know, sort of cynical. Maybe I'm a much more of an optimist, or a bit too optimistic as a journalist, but I do fundamentally believe, based on all the people I've met through my lifetime and my career, that deep down there actually is a sense of kindness, and I'm just doing my best out of pretty much everyone you deal with for the most part.
You both seem really chilled out as people, but you must get stressed. How do you handle it?
I get uptight before a program because I think, oh God, do I know enough? Am I prepared enough for this? But other than that, I can't say it's because I'm doing it quite a long time, because I don't think I ever got as stressed as some people do. And that's just, you know, that's just sheer good luck. That I don't think I ever got as uptight as some people do. Even when I was starting out, I don't think I was as physically nervous as some people get. And, you know, I think that's just sheer good fortune. I'd love to say that there is an exercise you can do, or, you know, maybe there is, and I don't know about it, or there is some kind of training that you can do. I don't know. I think when it comes to something like that, you're either a person who finds it easy to adapt, or you find it particularly hard. And I feel I was just fortunate in that respect, and that maybe I found the right thing for me almost by accident, when I realised, oh, I can do this without, even though I'm uptight, I'm always conscious, was I good enough? Did I know enough? Did I ask the right question? I don't have quite the fear that some people have, and I know I don't.
And Zara?
I would say, and I've said this before, it's unusual. I think I cope better under pressure, actually. Mm. I think I perform better under pressure. Mm. I actually think if I have too much time to do something, I'm just not as good. I think that I need to be given a tight deadline and I need to be told to get this done. And I think I thrive in that environment, actually. I would say the times that I get stressed is if there's been a couple of quiet days and I haven't brought in a decent story, then I start to get a bit stressed. You know what I mean? So I think that's probably more, which is maybe a bizarre thing to say, but I just think that I'm better under pressure in a stressful environment. I just think I perform at a higher level in that setting. I actually think it's in the quiet days. I need to learn how to like relax. Like I need to learn how to take a day off. I'm getting better at that now, I think, in a kind of post-lockdown world. I'm starting to sort of like claw back some kind of social life and stuff. But certainly, I think maybe the quieter days are when I get a bit stressed, actually.
Okay. Yeah. I think, you know, it's and you probably find this yourself over the years, that, you know, it's a bit of an adage in journalism, and it's true, that, you know, often the big days are the easiest days to cover.
Definitely.
And when there is a huge story, or be it an election programme or something massive that's unfolding over so many hours, you do get such a shot of adrenaline, and there are so many people to speak to. Those are in many ways the easier days. Yep. It's the days when nothing is happening, and when you're trying to make something out of nothing, and when you realise halfway through an interview, I haven't a clue what I'm talking about here. That those are by far the harder
days. Those water into wine days are desperate.
Yeah.
And do you think the industry is quite challenging still for women?
Yes, but not as challenging as when I started. You asked earlier about local radio. When I remember when I was working in Clare FM, I was 20 years old, and I was covering the county council. I used to do it every month. There were 32 councillors, 30 of them were men. The entire top table, county secretary, county engineer, county manager, they were all men. The chairman of the council was a man. All the other journalists were men. So you might get a room of between 40 and 50 people, and I'd be kind of sitting there thinking, one of these things is not like the others. Yeah, it felt so strange. And I do think there were very few women on the radio, perhaps slightly more on television. So I think some of those barriers are gone.
I do think it. Look, I do think there should be more women in roles. Like Rachel and I have kind of been really lucky in a lot of ways, and we've pushed through and we've worked to get to where we are. Like I would say, as a female journalist, you know, having male allies in the job is important as well. And Richard and Gavin, for me in particular, have been great male allies. They're my friends, but they also really support me and back me. And not that I need them to do that, but they do it anyway. And I think having that kind of support from male colleagues as well, and having men in the room who recognise and want to hear women's voices, actually, I think is a big part of helping us to improve that situation.
What advice would you give to somebody starting out today?
Well, Zara mentioned earlier that you have to be really keen on what you're doing. Now, there is a difficulty here, and it allies to the question of women's role now in the media. There need to be more women but in roles, but, you know, there are other issues as well. Say, one that I've always been particularly conscious of working in RTE is, you know, there are class issues too. There aren't enough working class people working in the media to this day.
I agree.
There are an awful lot of people from really quite privileged backgrounds working in the media are probably overrepresented. So I am conscious that it is easier for, say, a young woman from a middle class background to get ahead in media than it is for a young woman or a man from a working class background to get ahead. And I always try to remember that, because I think it's sometimes something that we now tend to forget. And my concern about the way the media is now is there is an expectation that a lot of people will work for nothing. One of my concerns would be that it would become harder and harder for people who have to earn as soon as they leave school or college to get a footing in the media, because there will be this expectation that, you know, you sort of spend years and years on basically glorified internships, and that would be one of my concerns.
Yeah, I would echo that concern, and I also would say as well, just to note in terms of diversity as well, I do worry sometimes that what we see on television here on the radio is actually not what we see on the streets in every town and city up and down the country. And I think that is actually a massive problem. And I think that as we move forward, you know, the media really does need to be more reflective of society. And I think that comes down to people like Rachel and I, you know, maybe reaching out and giving people a chance to come and work experience, you know, doing a day shadowing, that kind of stuff. It hasn't really been possible over the last 2 years, but certainly I think now into the next phase of this year, I think it's something that I personally would like to do a bit more of. You know, I think it's nice to, I feel like I got a lot of help from people, as you mentioned, they're coming up in my career, who, you know, gave me a dig out, left me shadow them for a day or two. So I think things like that are really important. But crucially, the point you made about people getting paid for internships is really, really vital. If you can't afford to live in Dublin, and let's be honest, a lot of the opportunities for internships are in Dublin. If you can't put yourself up, the accommodation costs in Dublin are enormous. If you can't do that, how do you get a foot on the ladder? And the one other point I would just make, actually, for, I always say this to aspiring journalists, is make a phone call. People laugh. I'm really big about phone calls.
Oh, gosh, yeah. Don't text.
These text messages and emails drive me insane.
Don't send a WhatsApp.
Make a phone call.
Lift the phone. Yeah. It makes such a difference. Yeah. And it is, in a way, it might be a harder thing to do because I suppose there's now a generation who have grown up without that and who assume that the normal way of contacting somebody is through an email or whatever. For an awful lot of people who make the decisions on these things, they expect a phone call.
I still remember I was about, I think, 21, and the features editor of the Irish Times at the time was a lovely lady called Sheila Wayman, and I would send the email pitch and then I would ring her, and that phone call, like,
painful but worth it.
But the trepidation. And the thought of being asked to then directly explain the stories and the pitches over the phone, and I was there with the notes next to, you know, and it was just one of those things. I was freelance for 7 years at the start of my career, so I know a lot about, you know, the rates, the circuitous route, and the instability of the circumstance. So you're absolutely right, it is a middle class profession,
and because I fear becoming more so, which is not good, and it means that one type of story is likely to predominate and we're likely to miss out on other stories because people's concerns won't be properly represented. And I do think that's important.
Yeah, certainly is. Well, before we come to a close, I want just to remind everyone to go and listen to the group chat, which is out now, available on podcast platforms. And of course, that's co-hosted with Richard Chambers and Gavin Riley, and also Rachel English's great new book is called The Letter Home, and it is in all good bookshops. Rachel English and Zara King, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a million, Nadine. Thank you.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
Now, Rachel is staying with us, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined now by Louise Campbell, Head of Learning and Development at Robert Walters, a global recruitment consultancy. Louise is in today, on the line today, to talk how to get that pay raise. Louise, you're very welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining us. Thanks. This is a hot topic, isn't it?
It sure is. It sure is. And I think it's an every year it's a hot topic, but now more so than ever. We see still in this day and age a lot of women who are still struggling to ask for a pay rise. I think it is improving, but more needs to be done on the employer's side to A, I think address the institutional bias that exists in the workplace, and B, not make this feel like it's such a difficult process for women. You know, negotiating your pay in your job should feel like a natural thing to do. But interestingly, we carried out a survey last year, a D&I survey, and we found that women continue to be less likely than men to negotiate salary. So in fact, we found that 45% of the women who we interviewed, and we interviewed thousands of women, have never attempted to negotiate their pay, which I just found astonishing.
And what are the reasons that they cite as preventing them from asking?
I think the main reasons were lack of confidence, and people were too embarrassed. So a lot of the women said that they just were a bit scared that they wouldn't get the raise, and they lacked the confidence to approach that conversation with their employer. Also, what I found really interesting was that a lot of female professionals felt that their manager subconsciously does not see them as the main breadwinner or provider, and so felt less inclined to give them the pay rise that they were asking for.
How do you counter that? How do you prepare going into a meeting if you do want to have a meeting in relation to pay?
Absolutely. I think that when you want to go into a meeting and discuss pay, you need to have, A, you need to be very well prepared, and you need to have a lot of information ready, because you want to be able to present the facts in a very much an objective and a non-emotional way. In order to do this, you need to be prepared. So look at a number of different factors. Look at previous appraisal documents. You know, have you achieved your objectives? Have you gone above and beyond what's expected of you? Look at your results. Have you grown new business areas? Have you taken on new projects? Have you won new business which has generated revenue for the company? Look at your general responsibilities or your management responsibilities. Are you supervising a new team? Has your remit expanded? You know, and really go back to the results and showcase your results against the targets that you've been set. If you are continuously overachieving, there is an argument to get a pay rise. You know, and I think that if at all possible, you know, when you are preparing for that meeting, because there are certainly things that you can practice in advance. Everything I think about a conversation around pay rise can and should be practiced in advance. You know, if even going back to the start of when you ask for the meeting, you know, the way that you ask for a meeting, prepare it. Don't just knock on your boss's door and say, "Have you got a few minutes? I want to discuss my salary." You know, because I think when you do something like that, your boss is going to feel attacked and may go on the defensive, which probably won't work in your favor. So give that due respect to each side to come prepared to a meeting. But when you're asking for a meeting, say to them, "I would like to book a meeting with you. The meeting is about my salary. I'd like to share some thoughts with you. If this week isn't right for you, I'd like to speak to you before the end of the month. So please let me know when would suit you." And if you do get a knockback then, if somebody says, if your boss says, "Oh, now is not the time to ask for a raise," I think you need to politely but firmly state that you would still like to meet them and discuss the reality of your role and your responsibilities as they have increased, or they're not an accurate reflection of your job description. Pre-meeting, again, I think you need to practice a few things. And, you know, this is where you bring along a friend or a family member and you say, "Look, I want to have this discussion with my manager in work. Can you have this discussion with me? Don't be my cheerleader. Come at me from a supervisory point of view." But practice things like your opening line. thank you for taking the time to meet with me. The reason why I've asked for this meeting is to discuss my salary. And this ties into a wider conversation around my role and my responsibilities and my achievements and the value I've brought to the business. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to run through this, and it would be great to get your feedback.
What are the common mistakes that people make when they're in the room?
I think the common mistakes are really looking at and getting a salary raise from an emotional point of view, and people linking their pay increase to the wrong factors. So, you know, I've had people in the past come to me and say, I want an increase in my salary because my personal costs have gone up, my travel has gone up, or I'm now paying a mortgage and my childcare is very expensive. And these are all really valid reasons, but they're not valid reasons to ask for a pay rise. I've had people come to me and say, I've been here 3 years now and I still haven't received a pay rise, anything, you know, anything but a rise in line with inflation. Or I've been here 6 months, I know how to do the role and I'm doing it successfully, totally forgetting the fact that the business has invested in them throughout the time when they weren't productive in any way, shape or form. One common mistake would be to compare themselves to other people. So this can be a really dangerous area to get into if you say, well, you know, I know that Mary is getting X and I'm only getting Y. Because immediately that's going to make somebody very, very defensive. And unless you are totally sure that you know what Mary is doing and that she's not doing any more than you, or have any other projects on the go that you're not aware of, it can be a dangerous thing to do.
And Rachel, to bring you in, anecdotally, you know, we've all had those conversations about pay and, you know, over the years, I've certainly had conversations where people will complain about their pay, but then they won't actually have asked. They won't have asked. They won't have. And there is that saying, if you don't ask, you don't get. So would your experience be similar? Have you had those chats with friends?
I have, but it is very, very hard. I don't think I know anybody who has ever been in that situation where they have enjoyed knocking on the door and saying, listen, could we have a chat about X, Y, Z? I've done it. I can't say I've enjoyed it. I've had mixed results in the past. But of all work-related things, it is so much, nearly anything else, it is easier to ask for. I've negotiated all sorts of things. But just that thought of when you go in and say, it's about money. It's just what is it about us? We're just, in the main, not very good at it.
And the fear factor as well is that you suddenly get very emotional and throw all your toys out of the pram and say, well, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
So is that...
And it is hard not to feel... in a way emotional about it, because maybe it does tie into your sense of self-worth and or of what you feel is what you're contributing. So it's hard to be impersonal about it, I think. I really do.
Well, Louise, what do you do if the request is turned down? If you're you know, having this lovely meeting where the boss is sort of nodding at you and saying, no.
Absolutely, because that does happen, you know, as Rachel has said. I think, you know, trying to, I know it's easier said than done, but taking the emotion and the subjectivity out of the conversation and sticking to the facts is something that I would just advise everybody to do. I think about, if the request is turned down, you really need to think about, before you go into this meeting, what is a good outcome going to look like? So if I'm going in and in my head, I'm going, I want 10%. Now, if you get offered 7%, is that a good outcome, or are you still not going to be happy? You need to know, I suppose, where your breaking point is. If you wanted an immediate raise, and if your boss says to you, "Well, look, we will look at this in January," is that going to satisfy you, or do you want this in writing, and do you want a promise or a guarantee of it? So, I think you need to look at your reasons for asking. Everyone has their own personal motivations for asking for a raise. But I think you need to go in with the mindset of being able to learn something and get that step closer to the pay rise that you deserve. You know, if you firmly believe that you are worth more money because of the role and the responsibilities that you have, and if your company is sitting there shaking their head saying, absolutely not, we're not in a position to do that, my advice would be to go and have a look and see what the market is paying. And if you know that you're underpaid in the role that you're in, I mean, now there has never been a better time to you know, go out and have a look and explore the market and explore other opportunities, because money is a huge motivator for many, many people. And, you know, it's very hard to sit there in a job when you know you are being underpaid. And if that is your motivator, you know, as I said, it's an incredibly busy market out there at the moment.
Louise Campbell, Head of Learning and Development at Robert Walters, the Global Recruitment Consultancy. Thank you so much for your insight.
Thank you.
How I Did It, the Business Post's Women in Leadership podcast.
And my thanks once again to all of our guests on the podcast today, Zara King, Rachel English and Louise Campbell. Join us next Sunday for the new How I Did It. And remember, you can find all of our episodes on the Business Post website, businesspost.ie/podcast. And you can also find us on Spotify, iTunes and many other podcast providers. Remember, do hit that subscribe button if you are on any of those providers, and that way you'll be notified when the new episode drops. This podcast episode was co-produced by myself and Catherine Healy. Right. Till the next time, do take care.
How I Did It, the Business Post Women in Leadership podcast.
Sponsored by Glandor, creating space for business to grow.